MI6 has been cloaked in secrecy and shrouded in myth since it was created 100 years ago. Our understanding of what it is to be a spy has been largely defined by the fictional worlds of greats like Ian Fleming and Jean Le Carré. Gordon Carrera now provides a unique and unprecedented view into the secret world and the reality that lies behind that fiction. His new book is The Art of Betrayal, The Secret History of MI6, Life and Death in the British Secret Service. It's a great pleasure to welcome Gordon Carrera to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Let us begin with an obvious question, which is why, really around the world, we are interested in MI6.
Well, it does have a remarkable reputation, and I think that reputation has been spread by the fiction. One former head of MI6 told me a story about a young member of his organization who'd gone into to Africa to meet a tribal chief who, as far as they knew, didn't even speak English. They knew nothing about him. There'd been no contact before with MI6, but they clearly needed the contact for some kind of work. And the MI6 officer walked up to him and extended his hand, and the African chief said, "Hello, Mr. Bond." And that gives you some idea that of the cachet that working for MI6 brings. And the former head of MI6 said to me, "I don't think we'd have got the same reception if we'd been working for the Belgian Secret Service." And so it's been valuable to MI6. The brand, the reputation spread by James Bond, spread by John Le Carré, spread by that world of fiction. And it's partly because those people who wrote that fiction had worked in British intelligence. And it's one of the interesting things is that the people who've created this mythical world often drew on their real-life experiences. John Le Carré had worked in MI5, MI6. Ian Fleming, who wrote the Bond books, had worked in naval intelligence during World War II. And so fact and fiction have intertwined when it comes to British intelligence to a remarkable degree. And what I wanted to try and do was pick apart where fact and fiction meet and where they diverge.
And we can talk a little bit about that in a moment. I am curious as to one of the things that I found so interesting in the book is, well, how MI6 was started in the first place and how it really changed in its mission and in its setup during and after World War II.
Well, that's right. I mean, it was founded, as you said, about 100 years ago. And interestingly enough, it was founded partly because of fiction, because it was a time of before the First World War of kind of spy fever, when everyone was convinced there were German spies in Britain. The writers would say, that at least we have the British Secret Service to depend on. Well, actually, it didn't exist at that time. And so they decided, well, we better invent one and we better create it. And so what became MI5 and MI6 were born around then. It really took on a very different role after World War II and at the beginnings of the Cold War. And actually, I mean, I think one of the interesting things is it was very gung-ho at the start of the Cold War and not always very successful. I mean, those early years at the start of the Cold War were pretty disastrous for MI6. And it took quite a while for it to get the measure of its enemy, the KGB, and really get up to speed. And it was only really in the 60s it started having any kinds of success against it and when it began to professionalize itself. And that's the period in which I found fascinating to delve into, is that period as it tried to learn through the late 40s, 50s, and 60s, and before it really had much success.
How has MI6 been successful? Give us some examples of their great successes.
Well, I think there are two cases which I look at in detail in the book, which I think are, if you like, two of the success cases. Both Russian cases, and both are called Oleg. One, Oleg Penkovsky, was run jointly by MI6 and the CIA in the early 60s, and a colonel in Russian military intelligence who played a key role around the time of the Berlin Wall crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and really provided valuable intelligence, which was vital to policymakers right up to the White House. And President Kennedy, although he, in the end, was caught and executed. The other Oleg is Oleg Gordievsky, who came in the 80s, first recruited really in the mid-70s by MI6, but really a key role in the early 80s. And he's very interesting because he's a spy who, where you can see, you can trace the impact of the information he provided on the highest levels of policy, because he was able to get Washington and London into the mindset of the Soviet leadership for the first time, really, and explain to Margaret Thatcher and President Reagan just what the Soviets were thinking, and actually just how worried the Soviet Union was about the West carrying out a first strike on them in the early 80s, and just how paranoid they were. And that actually led to a toning down of some of the rhetoric, and he was also able, for instance, when Gorbachev came on the scene first, to be quite instrumental in guiding particularly London in how to understand him. And when Gorbachev visited London, Oleg Gordievsky was working for the KGB station in London and was briefing Gorbachev during his visit, and also briefing MI6 on the visit, and was able to, you know, brief both sides, as it were, as an agent for MI6. And so I think he's an interesting case of a successful spy. I mean, you know, there are plenty of failures as well, but I think those are some of the most interesting success stories that you can point to.
When you say on your right hand, look at the relationship between Britain and the United States, and on the left hand, look at the relationship between the CIA and MI6, do those relationships mirror each other?
Yeah, I think they do to some extent, because one of the interesting periods when I start looking at this after the Second World War, the Brits, particularly MI6, still see themselves as the kind of the senior party. They've been around longer. The CIA is just newly formed. You know, they're fresh to the game. And the Brits think of themselves as, you know, the kind of the old masters showing the new guys how to do it. And it doesn't take long, actually, for the relationship to begin to reverse, partly because of the massive resources the US bring to it. And, you know, by the 50s and by the Suez Crisis, you can see that the power has shifted, and it's quite clear where it lies. And interestingly enough, that's mirrored in fiction. There's a great bit in the first James Bond book, Casino Royale, where, you know, James Bond is trying to bankrupt his opponent at the casino table and put him out of business. And unfortunately, you know, James Bond runs out of money, and so it's the CIA slide across an envelope of 32 million francs, saying, courtesy of the Marshall Fund, which he then uses. And that was actually based very much on the real experience in which Britain was having to go to America for secret operations, saying, you know, we've got a great plan to overthrow the government in Albania, you know, but we kind of need your money. And so pretty soon it became clear how the balance of power was shifting. But it's still a very complicated relationship between the MI6 and the CIA right to this day. And you could see that in the Iraq War and some of the intelligence flow between the two over that in the build up to it.
And how much of that is MI6 and their information, the CIA and their information, and the relationship between the two governments? Because we saw a very supportive British government that, quite frankly, got raked over the coals as much as President Bush did for the run-up to the war, and quite frankly, its very purpose.
Well, that's right. And I mean, British intelligence, MI6, took a massive reputational hit over the Iraq War, because the entire case in Britain for the war was built on intelligence which turned out to be false and which had come from MI6. And quite importantly, a lot of the American case for the war was also built on British intelligence that MI6 had supplied. And basically, there were agents who were giving false information to MI6, and MI6 basically failed in its quality control of those agents. I mean, they were simply making it up, you know, to serve their own agendas, sometimes even just because of the money they would get out of it. I mean, it was very much like Graham Greene's novel Our Man in Havana, where, you know, the quality control system failed. And that's exactly what happened. And I think that was a huge reputational blow to MI6, because it has always prided itself on being, you know, amongst the best at gathering this kind of human intelligence. And it was revealed to have got things badly wrong.
Gordon Carrera is the author of The Art of Betrayal, The Secret History of MI6. When you look at the latest Bond movie, Skyfall, there is some question as to the very existence of the agency, of whether it can hold up in this age of terrorism. How fictional is that?
Oh, I think it's interesting, because I think in the film, one of the things it plays on is, do we really need these spies who focus on people anymore. Isn't it all about technology? You know, isn't it all about cyber attacks and cyber and espionage? And can't you just do it all over, you know, computer networks? And it's true that the espionage game has changed enormously, because now you can try and steal information and carry out covert action by damaging things over computer networks rather than necessarily having to do it with people. But I think rather than getting rid of human intelligence, it's just changing it, because quite often, if you imagine, if you want to steal some information from a computer network or you want to sabotage it, well, what you need is you need a person who's going to put the memory stick and the USB stick and, you know, and stick it into the computer, which will do the damage or steal the information. And so you still might need to recruit a human spy to do that or to steal the password so that you can get into the computer system. So instead, I think what you're seeing is human espionage and the electronic cyber world coming together much more. But I don't necessarily think it's one replacing the other.
Please tell us that there's really a queue.
There has been a queue, actually. there has been a queue. I mean, it's one of the funny things that actually, you know, a few of the bits of Bond are real, and there was a queue who developed gadgets. But when you speak to people about it, the gadgets weren't nearly as successful as the James Bond film. I remember someone telling me that, you know, they got sent to the Congo during the Congo crisis in 1960, and someone said, you know, Q has sent out, you know, something really useful, which is going to help you if you get into trouble. And they said, well, what is it? And they said, this. If you ever get into a big crowd and they're about to attack you, drop this. And they said, well, you know, let's give it a go. And they went out into a ditch in the Congo and they dropped it. And it was basically a stink bomb, you know, and not only that, but it wasn't a very powerful stink bomb, you know, and that was it, you know, and that was the level of gadgetry in the early 60s. So, you know, I think, you know, there was a queue. There have been gadgets, but I'm not sure they're always, it's quite as portrayed in the fiction, just like the License to Kill isn't quite like that, like that in real life.
Not quite as fun or cool.
Yeah.
Looking at the title of the book, The Art of Betrayal, give us a sense of how betrayal lies at the very core of this agency.
Well, I think it's something that's often forgotten in the world of, you know, James Bond and that actually human espionage is about asking someone to betray secrets. It's recruiting someone, you know, who is, you know, whether it was a colonel in the KGB or whether it's an Iranian nuclear scientist, who is willing to betray and betray secrets. And it's a very personal thing. It can be a very risky thing. It's a very complicated thing ethically and emotionally for people. And it's a very human thing. And I think it's the human factor of betrayal and espionage, which I was most interested in, and why I kind of wrote about individual cases, because I think it's only when you get to that very individual sense of it, rather than the big bureaucracies and what the changes were, that you really understand what spying is about. And in some cases, it was MI6 which got betrayed rather than doing betraying, like the famous traitor Kim Philby, who was a very senior MI6 officer, who was the liaison to Washington, rising star, some tipped him for the top, but who all the time was working for the Russians and betrayed his friends and betrayed his colleagues. And, well, what was the impact of that? What did it do to the organization? You know, it made people paranoid. It made people convinced that there were traitors all around them. And so, you know, the human and the emotional impact of betrayal, I think, is very interesting and at the core of the story.
What are the challenges in researching a book about an agency whose very survival is based on secrecy?
Well, I mean, MI6 used to be incredibly secret. I mean, much more, for instance, than the CIA. Until 1994, MI6 did not exist, at least not officially. Everyone knew it existed, but the government would not acknowledge its existence. And it had no legislative standing. There was no form of oversight over it, nothing. And so you can see that it used to be incredibly secret. But, you know, I've been covering security issues as a journalist for the last, you know, 10 years or so. And it's been a fascinating 10 years because intelligence has been thrust into the public domain, you know, sometimes, you know, by choice when it's used to justify something like the build-up in the war to Iraq, sometimes, you know, because bad things have happened, like the London bombings in 2005, when people question what was the intelligence known about it. The intelligence chiefs have suddenly emerged into the public domain. And so, for instance, I was able to go and interview a serving head of MI6 in his office in Vauxhall Cross a few years ago. And that was a first, really, the first time anyone had been able to do that. And it's So it's been interesting because it's been this period in which they've been coming out of the shadows for the first time. And so I think for the first time you are able to write about this. Not a complete history. You can't sell everything. There are lots of secrets still there, but you can get at some of it.
You write in the book, toward the end of the book, about MI6 and their work on 9/11, on September 11th and the attacks in this country. Mm. Give us a sense of what their role was both before and after.
Well, MI6 had been drifting to some extent away from its American relations with the CIA in the run-up to that. A bit, there had been, it wasn't like the Cold War where you had a kind of common purpose. In the months before, though, there was intelligence coming in that something big was coming, but no one knew what it was or where. And the British intelligence chief will talk about that they sensed something was coming, and they talked to their American partners that something was coming, but they actually thought it was more likely to be something that would happen in the Gulf, in the Middle East, rather than in the U.S. itself. Then you have the attack, and actually the head of MI6 flies out to Washington. It's one of the first and only planes to be allowed into American airspace. Carries the head of MI6, the head of GCHQ, the kind of eavesdropping center, to go out and to go to Langley and meet with the American spy chiefs and to talk to them and to kind of gauge what's going on and offer their help. Although then there's a meeting a few days after in the American embassy, the British embassy in Washington, in which the Americans and the CIA start to outline, you know, the sense of how tough they'll be in the response. You know, famously, the gloves were going to come off, and you could sense the Brits were nervous about that, and you could sense they were worried about some of the attitudes coming across. And it became a very complicated relationship in the months after, with Britain working incredibly closely with what had always been its closest ally, but also nervous and drawn in to some of the things that the CIA was doing, which we now know have been incredibly controversial. The rendition program, for instance, how much did Britain know about that?
And then you have a world that is on edge as a result, and then you have the London rail bombings, and it just stirs that all up again.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's after that period around the London bombings, the US was very worried about Britain. It was very worried that there might be an attack on America launched from Britain, that all these radicalized people in Britain who'd carried out the 2005 London tube bombings might go off and do something in America. And so there's one conversation I recount where some American CIA officials come over to London and say, well, we know we've got a deal that we don't run our own operations in Britain, because there is this deal. It's a kind of no-spy deal, you know, where you agree not to run unilateral operations in each other's country. But the Americans go, but, you know, we're kind of worried and we'd like to run operations in the UK. And the head of MI5 actually turns to them and says, you try that and we'll arrest you, you know, because they don't want the CIA running around doing its own operations on the streets of London. And so you do get those bits of tension in what is still, though, one of the closest relationships you get in the intelligence world anywhere, though.
It is a fascinating book. It is entitled The Art of Betrayal, The Secret History of MI6. Any backlash, any comment from the government regarding the book?
Not an official comment, no. It was a funny story where I was at a couple of months ago, I actually broke my hand, and I broke my hand playing soccer. Nothing suspicious at all. But I was then at a reception, and someone who used to work for MI6 came up to me, and he said to me, "See what happens if you write about us." Looking at my broken hand, as if suggesting I'd been done over for writing the book. But I promise you, unless it was a very artful conspiracy, it was just an accident. But, you know, just a few comments like that, but no major comeback.
It's The Art of Betrayal, The Secret History of MI6. Gordon Carrera, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much.
Very nice. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Art of Betrayal, The Secret History of MI6, Life and Death in the British Secret Service. The book is published by Pegasus Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.